Hello and welcome to Room Escape Divas. And today, Amanda's going to talk about story and escape rooms.
Most of you who have, most of you who listen to the podcast know that I am all about story in escape rooms and just about everywhere else, really. So I am a story junkie and I've wanted to do a series about this before. What? Mike made a face.
No, no.
What you facing about, Mike?
I just turned on my...
Are you trying to say that Mike's not a story junkie?
Is your mic not on?
It wasn't on. Now it's on. Sorry. Just go.
Okay. So much like Errol's puzzle series, I'm hoping to do a series on story.
Oh, so this is going to be a multi-part series?
Maybe. Ooh, this
multi-part.
Might be the only one.
Just like my multi-part series that ended.
That ended
so far. I still plan on doing
Yeah, but we have to actually write them further. The one that I'm doing today is based mostly on my presentation at the Unconference that I did in February 2017. And I'm going to give the same disclaimers here that I gave there as well. This... this podcast is based on rooms that I have done in Ontario or experiences that I've heard about in North America. So if you're listening to this in some other part of the world and think, we totally have all this down, then you're probably right. I haven't played the games yet. But I know that in Ontario, story is not really all that focused on. So that's what I'm starting today. The other one is that this is very much a 101 story kind of thing. I am going to be going back to basics a bit. So if you're hoping for something huge and in-depth, I'm not there yet. So with that said, here we go.
I didn't have this many disclaimers for mine.
Of course you didn't.
I thought you were saying one-on-one. As opposed
one on one,
like, you know, when you play basketball one on one.
Yeah, no, that's totally not what I'm saying. 101. 101. Very different syllable.
Other people could have been confused, so it's good we clarify.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you, Errol.
Back
to story. So I'm actually going to start with a quote that Errol gave me. And it's from a guy named Bob Bates, and he wrote an article. He's a game designer who wrote an article called Designing the Puzzle. And so he says, "In the beginning, there were puzzles. At the dawn of adventure games, stories were practically non-existent, characters were heard from but rarely seen, and the measure of a game lay almost solely in the mental challenge it presented. Those days are over."
Bum, bum.
Bum, bum. Now, he's wrote this article. How old do you think this article is, Mike?
In the 90s?
Sorry, this is kind of our second time doing this, so now he knows the answer. Yes, it was written in 1997. And that's what? Is that 20 years ago now? That article is 20 years
Let's
old.
Let's not do the math. We'll sound old.
I think Settlers of Catan won Spiel des Jahres in 1996.
What? Yeah. Man. Anyway, Errol showed me this quote, and it's a good one to use because at the time that he wrote this, video games were in a very interesting place. They had evolved from being this cool new technology to a medium in which people used to express their stories and whatnot. And today, like 20 years later, he's absolutely right. It's not just about providing mental challenge. It's also about doing stories. There's plenty of video games out there, but
When came the death of adventure games?
About 1997.
Yeah.
Adventure games are dated. That's a whole other topic I could talk about in a separate video game podcast somewhere, but
we did a workshop on that at a con.
We did. That was so much fun.
So funny. Manpans brings all the new adventure games.
Yeah,
I am someone that did all the old adventure games.
Yeah, so video games today are very much influenced by adventure games of the past. But that's not what we're here to talk about today. We're here to talk about escape rooms. The reason this...
I've been told.
Oh, no. I'm sorry. I'm going to bring up video games a lot during this podcast.
Woo,
so,
video games.
The reason I bring it up, though, is because where video games were at that point, escape rooms are not there yet today. Escape rooms are still a young medium. It's still a cool new piece of entertainment that we use to have fun with our friends. And it hasn't really gotten to the point. It's not even close to the point where it is used as another storytelling medium. Because of this, there is a lot of debate going on in the community from time to time. From time to time, quotes like this come up. And I am quoting an actual Facebook comment that I found. This one was
did
probably...
I say it?
No, you did not say it. No. I'm not going to say who said it.
Are you, if you're going to call me out, I would like to know.
I'll call you out.
Oh,
if
awesome.
Yeah. So the average player hardly cares about story at all. There are players who care deeply about story, and they are vocal about that fact, but they are in the very small minority. The sad part about this quote, Ruby looks like she's going to say something.
That also sounds familiar.
You did sit through... presentation earlier, like months ago.
Okay.
But yes, it is from the Facebook enthusiast Facebook group. So, sorry, escape room enthusiast Facebook group. The sad part about that quote is that it's true, actually. The majority of players don't care about story. They're not walking into an escape room thinking, I hope I see a great narrative today. They are thinking, I hope I see a great experience. Or they're thinking that, too. The thing is, though, about this quote is I don't entirely agree with it. No, players don't care about story on the surface. Sorry, now I'm watching them do Lego. Keys!
Oh, that's a nice-looking key.
Yeah.
You might want to tell them ahead of time what we're all doing. Sorry, Manpans, we are listening.
Yes. Oh, no.
I'm ready, waiting to interject.
I know you're listening. Okay. So with this quote... is sort of like, well, why should we care about stories in escape rooms at all? It is a question that owners ask as well. Like, why should I put effort into something that nobody pays attention to? Well, as I said, yes, players don't care, but they don't care on the surface. Players do appreciate story, whether they like it or not. Stories are something that's a very human thing. We appreciate them on a chemical level, even.
Oh, chemical level. It's chemistry.
It's chemistry.
Always bringing it back to that.
Errol gave me a great book. I can't even remember what I did.
Woohoo!
Yeah.
Awesome.
I wish I could remember what it's called. I have it in my notes, but it's about just design. But they do talk about the chemical reactions that happen in our brains.
Are you talking about emotional design by Don Norman? Name, right?
Possibly. I have to look it up. But he does talk about the emotional reaction that happens in our, or sorry, the chemical reaction that happens in our brains when certain things happen to us. He did a test where he did a psychological test where he basically asked a bunch of people for money to donate to a charity, right? And then he showed a video to another group of people. And this video was about a dad, and he's telling a story about his son who's sick, and he tears up, and people in the room tear up, and then they fork over more money. That's the short version of that.
It's because, like those Thai commercials.
Yes.
You know those really sad Thai commercials? Have you not seen them?
No.
No. I see them on YouTube. Like, you know, it's like that Pantene commercial about that deaf girl who wants to be a violinist. And it goes, but they tell like this 5-minute story ahead of time of how she's in school. She desperately wants to be a violinist, but this pianist who is the antagonist, and she's grumpy, and she's going, nobody should be, you're deaf, you can't do this. But she's learning how to play the violin from a deaf homeless man. And then in the end, it just ends up being a hair commercial. But you've never seen any of these. Wow.
Oh, we're going to have to educate Ruby and make her cry. At any rate.
You haven't seen it?
They're all sad.
Oh, man.
Sad.
The point that Errol makes is that, yes, we connect more with an emotional story than we do with a simple fact.
People.
Right? And it's the reason when we tell stories of our escape rooms, we could easily just say, that escape room sucked, and leave it at that. But no, we want to tell all the stories about how we felt in it and how we threw things around. We want to tell this whole complex story.
I know you're going to say me.
No, I'm not just talking about a particular room, which you're not going to mention that we speculate may be closed, which may be a future podcast.
Can't wait.
So once again, why concentrate on stories then? Apart from the fact that humans like stories. Well, for one, it does enhance the experience of a game. Most people, your run-of-the-mill person going in is probably looking for an adventure as well as a challenge with their friends.
Adventure has a name.
On a more practical level, it can help you to get over some budget limitations you might have or get around budget limitations. You might not be able to afford a high-tech game, but you can always create a compelling story. Another one is that story is more pliable than gameplay or tech. I can speak for all of us when I say that we constantly had to change our story to fit the constantly changing game flow and whatnot in our events. And
that was my fault.
But it was much easier to do than getting a piece of tech that would, you know, that would not work and then would just be the focus of the entire room and everything would be ruined and whatnot.
It was Errol's fault.
But most importantly, it helps to create consistency in your game design. It helps anchor your room. It helps make the puzzles connect and make sense. And we'll get more into that as we go. So I'm going to go right back to the beginning and let's just define story itself. What is a story? Do you know, Errol?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, you're totally
for me.
Yeah,
I think story are characters.
I knew you were going to say that.
Characters and their motivations.
Ruby, do you have thoughts on what a story is?
Collection of different things that may or may not have happened that creates an experience.
Cool, Mike.
What Ruby said.
Cool. Can't cheat, Mike. Yeah. So pretty much, all of you are right. A story at its heart is somebody wants something and something or someone.
I was right. That's really close to what it is. Wow.
Yeah. Okay, story is characters.
I can't remember this part.
So
nobody
remembers
everything.
So like I said, a story is somebody who wants something and something or someone is preventing them from getting it. That's pretty much what almost every story is. It's, you know, a character who needs to overcome an obstacle to get what they need. Stories should, there's some, you know, stories vary from medium to medium, but they all have some core elements that they share. One, they have characters. Those characters do not have to be human. Two, they have a structure, a beginning, a middle, and an end. How that is displayed is up to the medium. And three, they have to be believable. They have to create a world and people have to believe in that world. I walk down the street to the store to get some gum. That's technically a story. it's not an interesting story. There's probably in more interesting ways I could tell it, what happened between me and the store and the gum and
whom
everything.
Who did you meet there?
Who did I meet?
You beat
whom
me
did
to
I
it.
Meet on the way there?
Oh, oh. Did somebody... you go on the bus?
No, no. Oh, shut up. There's a story there. There's a story about me seeing a guy at a bus stop and Errol mortifying and embarrassing me.
What?
What? No. Me? A cherub? So first things first, let's talk about characters. As Errol said, stories are characters. All stories have characters in them. They are incredibly important. I'm just going to talk generically right now, then we'll apply it to escape rooms. But characters, they have goals. Every character has a goal, whether it's good or bad. Characters must overcome obstacles to get to these goals. Otherwise, it's not an interesting story. Rarely do you hear a story about somebody who gets everything they want right away. No one really wants to hear those stories. Maybe they do, but again, they're not very interesting. Characters, and this is very important, always believe that what they do is best. The best villains, villain characters out there always believe that they are doing the right thing. They might not, they probably won't be, but in their mind they have justified it. So that's always their motivation. Characters should change. They don't always change, but characters often change through a character arc. So they have a journey that they make from beginning to end. And, well, characters should be interesting. People should consider, like, every characteristic of a character. How do they talk? What is their personality? What motivates them? These are all things to consider with characters. When it comes to escape rooms, it's a little bit more difficult. The thing is that escape rooms, like I said, are a new medium, and we're still figuring out how to best do this. So let's talk about characters first that players might discover in an escape room, whether through an actor or tangentially? I don't know. I can't pronounce that word. Tangent. The problem with escape rooms is that characters are a lot more difficult to get attached to. With any story, it's absolutely essential that you get attached to a character because you want to stick through it. This is especially true in video games because you might spend 17 hours with a character. And if you don't like them, you'll turn off the video game. So video game writers have an especially hard time. But unfortunately, with escape rooms, the players rarely have any exposition to set up the characters they are going to meet in the game. I'll get to the exposition part, but it's, again, pretty difficult. They also have no immediate personal connection with a character. Like, I know the ones that we go into, it's like, you have to save this girl. You don't know who she is. You're supposed to care about her, but you've never met her or know anything about her.
We don't care.
And this is because this makes it hard too, because the players are also your characters. And so if you make another character in game related to your players, then it's a lot harder for them to, you know, work up the motivation to care.
A lot of the conflict can happen between
the players.
Which makes it more fun for all of us.
For you. It makes it fun for you. Instead.
No. I don't mean like arguing conflict. Oh. I mean like trolling
conflict. Yeah. Errol doesn't have an arc as a character. He does not change, I don't think.
Oh, what?
Oh, and are you changing now? Are you going to have a
changing man?
Okay.
Like at one point in time, I liked.
And back to man pants.
No, I still like matcha. What are you talking about? No, matcha's awesome.
Well, there goes his character arc. Okay. And unlike video games, where characters are often an avatar that players will map themselves onto, in an escape room, players are the avatar. So there you go. The thing that people don't, I find that some designers don't keep in mind, is that players are characters as well. And that the role of the player is just as important as the characters you create in your storyline as well. A role of the player will define what direction your story is going to take. So if you have something like, say, let's say we have a murder escape room. There's a murder scene that you guys walk into, right? If the player is, say, a police officer, then their goal is to, well, find out who the killer is and solve the crime. That will define their obstacles, and that will define, like,
their motivations.
Where the story goes. However, let's just say that the player is the killer instead. Well, then.
Plot twist.
Maybe your goal is to clean up the murder. That vastly changes the story that the designer has to set out to do. It all depends, right? And so that should be one of the first questions that designers should be asking themselves when they're designing a room is, what are the rules of the players? Because that will affect everything. Yeah. Escape rooms are great too because they are kind of natural. They're naturally providing an obstacle for the player. So, you know, you're oftentimes when you go into an escape room, your goal is to get out. There. That's your obstacle right there. The obstacles are the puzzles. Your goal is to get out. When we're creating characters for an escape room, when we're creating characters that aren't the players, for instance, you have to consider every detail of them. Even if players never see these details, it's very important to, you know, to map this out for yourself. So
because Scott will ask.
Scott will ask because people like me and Scott will come in and we will ask why certain things are the way they are. Especially in things like, and I don't like serial killer rooms all that much, but serial killer rooms would really lend themselves well to doing a character history, because if there's anything I hate, it's an inconsistent serial killer. So but when you're writing a character, you know, you can write down the basic stuff. You can write down the name, the sex, the race, the age, intelligence, education level, profession. You can go into it like what's known as a deeper dive. It's where you go into the character arc and like go into their character arc, how they're going to change. What do they desire? What do they like? What do they hate? What do they value? What are their key flaws? What are their vices? These are things that you might not consider right at the outset, but that will give you give your character a lot more depth and will give your room a lot more depth as a result. Then there's the visual aspect of it. There's their physical attributes, their clothing. And as far as escape rooms go, you can also consider, how do they decorate? How would they, if this is their house, how would they decorate their house? And that goes back to their likes and their dislikes and whatnot. So characters are really important, and we'll get back to the problems that we have with like getting attached to them in a little bit. I'm kind of just breezing through these right now. But so the second thing that stories have is a structure. All stories have structure. I am going to focus on a particular structure because most other structures stem from this. It's known as the three-act structure. If you know you took English in high school, you might remember this. It's really boring. In his puzzle podcast, Errol mentioned this as well. It was known as a tension curve, was it? Tension map? Tension curve?
Hyperbole?
Is this the Star Wars graph?
This is the Star Wars graph.
Woo! Star Wars. The three-act play, and now we're talking about
the tension. So Errol introduced a tension curve during his puzzle design process. So the thing with a story is that it's a series of obstacle and crises, and part of those obstacles is a ramp up in tension. So a character will encounter an obstacle, the tension will ramp up, they might solve that obstacle, there'll be a ramp down in tension, but it slowly builds. And so I'm going to quickly go through three-act structure. Act one, you have your exposition and setup. This is a very crucial part of the storytelling process, and it's also one of the most difficult. This is where the audience gets the information they need to understand the story. The characters are introduced, the world is introduced, they are eased into the story. At that point, there's the inciting action. This is when the character is introduced to the main conflict. That's the end of Act One. It's probably one of the shorter parts. It's the shortest part of the three-act structure. Act Two is the longest. So when you move into Act Two, once the inciting action happens, Act Two starts. It's the largest of the acts. And in movie history, actually, it's often split up into two. So it's actually a four-act structure. Act two is payoff for setup in act one, and it's set up for the resolution in act three. So this is where most of the tension building happens. In fact, it's where all of the tension building happens. What am I saying? You get what's known as the rising action. The characters begin to confront their obstacles. There's a rise in tension caused by crises. There's a short relief period after each crisis, because if you had a constantly tension ramp, like constant tension ramping up in a play or a movie, the audience gets really tired really quickly.
Like a Michael Bay movie.
Oh, no, Michael Bay has moments. He knows when to ramp down the tension a little bit.
Ramps down? It's just like constant explosions.
Oh, there's still moments where the characters will talk to each other. It just gives the audience a moment to breathe.
Maybe I'm watching the... Maybe I'm watching the...
Michael Bay did Transformers.
Ah, got it.
Gotcha.
More than meets the eye.
Yeah.
I'm watching the bootleg movies then.
Autobots in their battle to destroy the evil forces of...
As the... Right.
Stop distracting man pans.
Oh, this is fun. Okay. And so as the action rises, they'll keep meeting obstacles and meeting obstacles and meeting obstacles, and this all culminates in the climax, which is the highest point of tension in Act 2. It's just the highest point of tension in the entire story. This is where the character sees the epiphany, they see the path to success that they need to overcome their obstacle, and this is where Act 3 starts. This is where they start putting those plans into place. Act 3 is the end and resolution. It is a complete, usually, depending on what type of medium you have, there is eventually a downward motion in tension. And so this is when the audience sees the result of all the characters' decisions in Act 1 and 2. And whether it's successful or not, the conflict is resolved. So it doesn't have to be successful, but the conflict is resolved. So that's the basic story structure.
Are you going to give us an example?
So let's take Star Wars, for instance.
Akira. Yeah.
I've never seen Akira. Why don't
like
you
a
run
classic
us through it?
I know. Why don't you do Totoro?
Totoro plays around with that structure a lot. Yeah.
Okay. You can go, man.
Oh,
Totoro.
Man. Totoro, well, it has a good exposition. Act one is pretty standard, actually. Mm-hmm. You have the two girls introduced. You have the world introduced. They're moving into a country home. You get to see them. It's probably one of the longest act ones there is, right? You just watch them get used to the world. You get introduced to the characters. Act two, the inciting action. The problem is, it's like, this is assuming there is a point to Totoro. There is a point. There is a point to Totoro. It's to meet Totoro. So I would say that one of the inciting actions is when, is it May?
Yeah.
It's when May goes searching through her garden and discovers Totoro for the first time.
You know, the thing is, I would say that for the rest of our readers and listeners who have no idea what this is.
You challenged me.
No. You can get to the climax. Or you can get to the...
Oh, boy. So there's a series of... I don't even know if there are any obstacles going through it. There are. No, there are. Well, that's kind of one of the, I think,
the main one is May gets lost.
Spoilers.
To Totoro.
That's the big climax, is that May gets lost. They have adventures with Totoro. I thought that maybe, now I'm like, the three act structure does really very much apply to Western literature. So like I said, in other cultures and whatnot, that kind of structure gets played with and whatnot, but this is the one I'm going with. But yeah, the climax is May gets lost. She's lost, and her older sister is searching for her.
Poor May.
She doesn't know where to go, and she eventually gets help from Totoro himself. She goes running for Totoro to go search for him, for May. And they find her, and then it's resolved. So that's the main conflict. The thing is that the main conflict isn't introduced until like an hour into the movie. So... another conflict is that their mother is sick, I guess. They are May's feeling a little bit lost from that, I think. Well, it's the reason she runs away. She wants to see her mom.
I should have given you, like, Spirited Away. That might be a bit easier.
Oh, that's just a titch easier. Well, we could use Star Wars. Everybody knows Star Wars.
Well, not everybody. My wife wouldn't know what Star
That's
Wars
That's true. Not everybody
was.
Knows yes. Star Wars. The more people know Star Wars than they would Spirited Away.
A few months ago, I would not know Star Wars.
Oh, there you go. But Star Wars, for instance, is a very classic example of the three-act structure and of the hero's journey, for that matter.
You Which get, we didn't explain.
No, I'm not going to get into that today. So the hero's journey for Star Wars, you have Luke. You get introduced to him and his world and the world of Star Wars. He gets introduced to the world of the Jedi through Obi-Wan Kenobi. The inciting action, but I think that the inciting action of Star Wars is when Luke gets knocked out by the sand people and gets dragged in by Obi-Wan Kenobi. That's his inciting action. The inciting action of the movie might be when C-3PO and R2-D2 are launched into space and land on Tatooine. That's what. Without that happening, none of the movie would happen. So, if they hadn't gotten to that escape pod and gotten the plans to Tatooine, there you go. At that point, there's several obstacles in the way. You know, Luke wants to get off the planet. He can't because his aunt and uncle suck. Oh no, but then they're killed. That's how we solve that problem. Luke and Ben want to get off the planet. They don't know how. They meet Han Solo, who will fly them off. Han Solo can't get off because he's got a bounty on his head and he owes Jabba. Well, he sneaks off and flies off in the Millennium Falcon.
Killed his aunt and uncle.
Oh my gosh!
Just so that he can get him off the planet.
Yeah. And so on and so forth. The climax for Star Wars comes when Luke finally accepts his destiny, that he is putting his, training forth, and he shoots he shoots the Death Star, basically.
Pew, pew.
Him accepting his pew, fate pew. And seeing what he has to do in order to win the day is the climax. Everything after that is denouement. It's wrapping everything up, wrapping up the loose ends. It's a very classic three-act structure story. I talked way too long about that. Sorry.
We can go back to Totoro if you want.
We could go back to Totoro, but no. The story structure when it comes to games, so it is a very, the structure's played around with a lot, especially in video games. So video games have a problem in that a movie script is 2 hours long, maybe, right? And it can be very tightly paced and very tightly controlled by its writer and editor, right? It's a conglomeration of talents. However, with a video game, it's a lot more difficult because you have players like Errol, for instance, who decide. So one of the books I read, which is called Slaying the Dragon, Writing Great Video Games, one of the writers of that used to be a screenwriter. Oh, he still is a screenwriter, but he writes for video games now as well. And one of his greatest challenges was dealing with the pacing problems in games. And because the thing is that in games, your players are your characters, and your players are going to do whatever the heck they want in the environment, like Errol. The classic example that I always use is Errol and I played, or I tried to get Errol to play Amnesia the Dark Descent. It's a scary game. It's a very slow build, scary game. And it's meant to, you're meant to start exploring. It is meant to be explored, but we started up the game. The spooky music was happening. I was all tense, and there was creepy sound effects around, and we go into this front hall, and then Errol starts looking around and picking up chairs and putting down the chairs and picking up rocks and seeing if he can throw them through windows. And half an hour later, we're still in the front room. And we're still picking up rocks and stacking chairs now. And now we found a dresser that we can open the drawer of. And Errol wants to move the clothes inside the drawer, but the game won't let him. But gosh darned if he isn't going to try. And I have lost all feelings of scariness at this point. It's just one of those, oh, please let something just happen.
It was a fun game.
A lot of random stuff.
Yeah. So
you guys saw that when I was playing the virtual reality game. I have. I did die. I didn't. I didn't solve the first puzzle.
I don't think so. Escape rooms have something in their favor, at least for writers, in that you introduce the timer once again. Players have an hour to finish the game. Whether they do it or not is, you know, up to them if they can solve it or not. But that does give you a lot more control over how the story will flow. It still doesn't give you control for how the player will act in your environment, but at the very least, you don't have to worry about this big open world game and how you're going to pace that. So when it comes to escape rooms, like I said, the introduction of the timer does make things easier. However, there's a lot of difficulties when applying a story structure to an escape room. For one thing, there's barely room for exposition. Most escape rooms start at the inciting incident. You have been kidnapped, right? You rarely have much time to set up the world for a player. And it makes sense, because in the end, players want to play.
Half of us aren't listening to that intro story.
Half of them aren't listening to it anyway.
Well, maybe 2/3 with enthusiasts.
Yeah.
Actually, you're listening. You go, man.
I try, but you guys are all yelling things at each other about puzzles.
I'm not yelling. It's Mike.
I found a chair.
It's Mike that goes and starts searching. It's not me. I do other things. This is true. I'm looking for cameras and waving at them and taking my shoes off. But I am not starting the game because I'm trying to be fair.
But it does make sense because, like I said, players want to play. They want to start the action. So designers have a challenge in that they need to somehow introduce the story without making it too cumbersome for the players. And this is done through environmental storytelling. Players need to learn about the story by interacting with the environment rather than being told it in a setup scenario. So environmental storytelling is something that's used in video games quite a bit, and it's something that is being used more in escape rooms now. It embeds the story into the...
Is that like putting a newspaper clip on a bulletin board that you have to read?
That is, actually. That would be considered environmental storytelling.
Still an awful lot of reading.
It is an awful lot of reading. I will give other examples.
Oh, good.
So, environmental storytelling basically embeds the story into the environment itself, and it's incredibly useful to escape room designers. It can be found in physical objects. It can be found in documents, as Errol said. It doesn't have to just be letters. It can be receipts. It can be like just smaller things here and there. It can be done in audio or video type of settings, like whether that's somebody narrating or like whether it's like a tape recorder that you find or whether it's a soundscape, you know. So if you walk into a room and you hear like dripping and hollowness without seeing anything, you might think you're in a cave, for instance. That would indicate that. If you walk into a room and you see, say, a pool of blood and a rusty knife on, like, thrown to the side and, you know,
we're in a butcher shop,
handprints,
right?
On the wall. Let's say it's a living room.
Butcher.
Or basement. You can make assumptions about what happened here.
Butcher.
Somebody got hurt.
Wait, clarification. When we bought the house, there was already a pool of blood there and weird handprints and stuff. I did not do that.
Thanks, Mike. No knives. Did you actually think I was like referencing your house?
Referencing Mike.
Oh, dear. There's a quote here from Evan Skolnick, who wrote Video Game Storytelling, and I really like it. You've probably heard the expression show, don't tell, when you're doing a movie and whatnot. It means, you know, don't just narrate what's going on to people. Show them. It's a visual medium. Show them what's going on. Don't just say, like, wow, look at that guy fly through the air. It's like they can see it. You don't need to. Okay, whatever. Evan Skolnick takes it one step further, and he says, first, try to find a way to let the player do it. Your second choice is to show it. And finally, your last resort is to tell it. Believe it or not, people are smarter than you think. It's we don't need to tell everybody and give them an info dump for fear that they will not get something. There was another thing I read in the video game storytelling, and in that when you're thinking of what your plot, you first need to you need to split it up into several parts. You need to split it up into parts that the players need to know. What do they absolutely need to know to finish this game, right? What story points? The next one is, what might they like to know? What isn't necessary for them to finish, but is still useful for them to learn about the story? And then the rest of it is basically filler. It's the stuff that is might be okay to learn, might be fun to learn, but is absolutely not necessary to enhance the experience. So that will really help when, you know, I've rarely been in a room, though, where I've where there's been too much story thrown at me. I'm trying to think. It's usually been in a letter form. Suddenly we'll get this like single spaced, full page, 10-point font letter that explains the whole story. And that's when I just check out. I'm pretty sure that not all of that information was necessary.
When Manpans checks out, then you've done it wrong.
Yeah.
I've checked out at the beginning, but yeah, Manpans checks out. Uh-oh.
When it comes, if you're curious about environmental storytelling, like, there's few escape rooms that I can think of that I can reference, you know, these types of things. Environmental storytelling has a lot of detail in it. And if you can aim for that, that's great.
What about some of mine? Okay, you made it too. Yes.
I made it too.
I know, I'm being a jerk.
For instance, like, if you're ever curious, look up the opening video to the first BioShock game. It's one of the best examples of environmental storytelling that I've seen ever. It's, you go down in a submarine and the world is introduced to you just through this visual and through your actions with the world as well. And it's great. And if you stop and you linger in that hallway, you'll see all sorts of detail that the designers put in there that foreshadows later plot points, but that, you know, obviously you wouldn't get it at first glance, but that doesn't mean that they wouldn't put it in. Same with a story. If actually, I was going to say Gone Home, which is a video game known as a genre called Walking Sims. I don't like that name, but that's what they're commonly known as.
Think it's apt.
It is. It's like a game essentially where you walk and there's no actual gameplay. But it's mostly a storytelling type of experience. And I would highly recommend that any designer play a walking sim. I would recommend Gone Home and Firewatch. Those are great examples of putting things into the environment that tell more to you than, say, just writing it out on a piece of paper or having a character narrate it to you would. You never actually meet the characters in Gone Home, ever. Or, like, you don't meet them physically face-to-face. You meet them through the objects in their bedrooms. You meet them through... So, for instance, I found at some point a receipt for some jewelry, and I knew from that receipt that...
Was this a spoiler? You're telling them that they should play it, okay, now you're
no,
spoiling
I'll
it.
I'll say a lesser one. So, for instance... I'm holding a picture here that I'm looking at. There's a point where I picked up a book in the game and it's called Making Friends. And on the book is a post-it that says, Sam, thought this might help, Dad. So that tells me that this character, Sam, is having a tough time of it and that her dad's trying to help her out. And
what if it's something I give to Echo?
Then if anybody found out anything more about you, they'd eventually learn you were just trolling her as a father. So I don't think this dad's like you, though.
Oh, boring.
Any thoughts, guys, that you have from story structure in escape rooms? Anything you want to share?
I like BioShock.
You like BioShock?
Well, she was talking about BioShock. So we could give an update of what we're doing. Ruby has the bunny.
Ruby has the bunny.
I have a bunny.
I have a bunny. Do you want the other bunny too? Okay. Mike, doesn't have alcohol, but he has water.
Mm-hmm. And Errol's building Totoro still.
In Lego. I don't think they know what I'm doing because that was in the previous.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
okay. Well, Errol's building a Lego Totoro. Woo-hoo! The pieces are super tiny. And it's super difficult. We'll have to take a picture to post this because it's like, you know.
It's hard to explain.
finally, this is very important. Stories have to be believable. And this is one of the hardest things in escape rooms, I think, these days. The duties of a storyteller. So when a storyteller is telling their story, obviously, they must present an artificial and complete world featuring custom-designed characters who experience carefully crafted events, actions, and reactions. But it must appear to audiences as a real, complete world featuring genuine people who experience spontaneously unfolding events, actions, and reactions.
Whoa.
And that, again, is from Evan Skolnick in Video Game Storytelling. And that's really hard to do.
Explain it like I'm five.
Explain it like you're five?
Yeah.
So in other words, I have to make up something, but it has to be believable to you. It has to seem like it's all new.
Okay, cool.
Get it? In order to do that, the storyteller and the audience kind of go into a pact. They enter what's known as the suspension of disbelief. So an audience, in this case, agrees to suspend their disbelief and pretend they are not getting something fabricated. You know, we don't... Did you lose a Lego piece?
You did.
Goodness gracious me. We don't walk into a movie and think that we're going to get a real thing. We know that there's going to be unbelievable aspects to this, but we're willing to forgive that if the storyteller makes that suspension as easy as possible. So we notice when rules aren't followed. So let's take something like The Matrix.
So rules that fit within the world.
Within the world that's
so
set
not
up.
So, not so much our rules.
No.
Like physics.
Exactly.
You know what I learned?
Yeah?
Did I say this in the last podcast?
I don't know.
It was about...
What is it about?
CPR.
Oh, that it never works?
Well, it's like a 1% success rate. You know when they do the pumpy pumpies on the chest? And then in every movie, it works every time. But it doesn't in real life.
It's not...
It takes a lot more effort in real life, too.
Yeah, and then you break ribs. And explosions, too. You know, explosions, if you're really close to it, it kind of like ruptures everything inside. But not in movies. It
not
can propel
in movies.
You
no.
to another car, and then you can take it over.
So, sort of what I'm talking about, like... I'm going to use The Matrix as an example. Sorry if somebody hasn't seen The Matrix.
So many spoilers.
But The Matrix is a physics-bending movie, right? And when we see Neo, one of the main characters, flying through the air, we completely accept it because that is the rules of that the world has set up, right? If we see something break those rules, if suddenly he hurts himself in some way, or if suddenly... You know, he does something in later in the movie that doesn't apply to how it was set up previously. Our suspension of disbelief is broken momentarily and we are drawn out of the experience and then we get pissed.
It's like when a character suddenly becomes super powerful and then later on you think to yourself, why don't they just do what they did before?
Exactly. And
then super powerful characters become hard.
Yes. Yeah, so that actually is a big problem in video games as well. You have cutscenes where they're like banging on a door or they're like... Although the worst one is Tomb Raider, I think. And it completely drew me out for a moment because Tomb Raider, you're killing men left, right, and center, and suddenly she kills a man with a gun for the first time, and there's a whole cutscene where she like... suddenly breaks down sobbing because it's the first man she's killed. And I think, no, it wasn't. Why is this difficult for you? It's like, you just saw a whole bunch of men die. You didn't break then. I don't know. So it's that sort of thing. In order for a story to be believable, it has to be consistent. And this is the absolute most important point in escape rooms as well.
Yeah, that's like, you know, Scott Nicholson's Ask Why paper.
I'm going to get to that.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so consistency in a game means consistency both in characters and in the world building. So with characters, consistency does not always mean a character does the same thing. Consistency means that they do what makes the most sense for them at that time in their arc, not what is most convenient for the story. So if you've ever seen a TV show where a character hates another character, but suddenly they have a heart to heart for no reason other than the fact that the plot needs them to get along suddenly, and there's no build up to that, and you don't think... I'm going to go back to Star Wars, actually. If Han Solo shoots somebody, I will believe that he would shoot somebody because that is something Han Solo would do. If later on in the movie, when he goes back to save his friends, that's believable because we've seen him change and make friends with these characters over the series of over the course of the arc. If he had remained the same and been all like, I hate everything, I hate you, blah, 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 then... You know, it would have been believable if when he suddenly turns back and helps them. However, we see him, you know, change over the course of the movie. Characters always do what they think is best, too. I'll just reiterate that. Consistency in world building, like I mentioned, is setting the rules of the world and then abiding by them. If you make a rule, you have to follow it. You can't just break it because it's, you know, convenient for your plot to move forward. This is the same. Errol brought this up in puzzle design as well. You have to be consistent with your puzzles and they have to fit the theme. Sudoku might seem like a great idea in a spaceship, but it doesn't make a whole lot of sense in that world. Unless one of the characters loves Sudoku. You don't know. So if you set it up, then by all means do it. But if you don't set it up and it doesn't make sense, It's not gonna jive with your players.
It's also about consistency. If you set different patterns and different rules within your puzzle world, and then if you suddenly change it,
right,
and you don't give people any kind of notice that you've broken your own rule that you've laid a pattern for, then it's very confusing once you finally tell them solution, and it doesn't fit what you've been doing throughout the whole game, and that usually happens when people just randomly throw puzzles in without thinking about it.
Yeah. When you're doing a world building, like no matter what kind of escape room you're building, if it has a theme of any sort, build a world for it. If you're just throwing puzzles in a room, fine, do that.
What? No.
No, I should say there's nothing wrong with having just a puzzle room.
No, just a puzzle room makes sense, but just don't throw puzzles in a room.
Okay.
You should have a structure.
That's for the puzzle design podcast. But when you're doing world building, you put way more work into it than anybody will ever notice. This does not make it not worth the effort, because it will show in the experience that they have. I'm going to mention this briefly. Let's talk about surprises. I have... so far to date, played one escape room in which there was a surprise in the story that actually got me. Mike's looking confused.
Which one?
I know which one.
Was this one of ours?
No.
No. Man!
Pat yourself on the back.
I didn't see what I wrote coming.
Oh my god. So it's called Outbreak and it's in Toronto here.
Yeah.
And it's really, surprises are really tough to pull off. First, and this is from Scott Nicholson's paper, Ask Why. The problem with the surprises is first, it needs to be a surprise, something that the player does not seem coming, but it still must make sense to the story. I'm not going to discuss any details, but if you've ever seen The Sixth Sense, for instance, the reason it's one of the greatest plot...
Spoilers!
The reason it's one of the great plot twist movies ever is because you find out the plot twist and everything before it makes sense, but it's still quite shocking. Unless, Mike, was it you who guessed it right away? Somebody told me they did.
Usually it's Ruby. She figures it out within like 5 minutes. She's like, it's probably the guy's... Whatever.
Yeah.
That didn't make sense. Sorry. Same sort of thing with puzzles. Once you finally solve the puzzle, it all fits in place and all the clues point to the right solution. And you go, how could I not see that?
So in when it comes to surprises or plot twists, usually the way that these are pulled off is that there's seeding and planting done beforehand. That's what the terms are. So seeding and planting are terms which mean that there's subconscious clues set up for the audience, just set the audience up for the surprise. So they have to be subtle so that the audience will realize after the fact. But you know, not so obvious that it's going to come from a mile away. Sometimes people do this through colors. Sometimes people do it through code words or something. Sometimes if you watched Aliens, for instance, this isn't exactly a surprise, but they're setting up a Ripley as being able to work this machine, this mechanic thing. I can't remember what it's called. What is that thing called that she uses at the end?
Exoskeleton.
Exoskeleton. So they set her up as being competent and knowing how to use an exoskeleton. Now, this isn't a surprise at the end, but it is a, you know, it still has to make sense that she would know how to use it.
What does she do?
They have a demonstration of her using it earlier in the movie. So she offers to do that. They have a whole scene. It's a pretty pointless scene at first because it's like, what's the point of this? Other than showing that she's competent and that she's independent, what it does is it's setting up for later when she goes and fights Queen Alien and comes out in this exoskeleton. Shut up. It's
the old movie's super old.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. It's hard to talk about surprises. I won't talk about The Sixth Sense, although I want to.
What happens in The Sixth Sense?
Hmm?
Dot, dot, dot.
Dot, okay. Dot, dot. So how does this all apply to escape rooms? Well, like I said, there's one escape room I've played so far that actually surprised me with a plot. I won't say what that is. I will say to go play it just to see it as an example. It was quite clever, and I have yet to see it since. I will admit it's hard to pull off. I'm going to mention, now this is where I mentioned Scott Nicholson's paper, Ask Why. If you have not read it yet, look it up, Google it. It's on the internet. It's incredibly useful when talking about immersion in an escape room and about narrative in an escape room. Basically the gist of it is whenever adding an element to a room, ask why it's there. In fact, it's a good thing to listen to your beta testers. If they ask why something is in the room, then it probably means it shouldn't be there. Or if they ask why and you don't have an answer for them, then you really have to rethink why you have this thing in the room. And this includes both your set design and your puzzles and everything. Always ask why. Always constantly be asking yourself, why is this here?
Like laser mazes in Egypt. Sorry.
Yeah, like laser mazes in Egypt. If you have an answer for it, if your answer is because aliens built the pyramids, great. That's a reason.
I'm pretty sure that wasn't the story with the room I played.
It was not. So they did not ask why enough. Other things to consider when it comes to world building and what's mentioned in Ask Why is to think about the world outside of the escape room. So you might be in a bunker for some reason. Think about what's going on outside the bunker. Don't just think about your immediate setting. Think about the world outside of it as well. Because again, that will affect your design and it might affect, you know, are people trying to radio in? What might you hear on a radio? What kind of newspaper clippings might there be? It's not just about your immediate setting. These are all things to consider. Any thoughts so far? I'm sort of wrapping up soon, but... Errol, you look expectant.
No, I'm...
Okay.
We can talk about
so overall,
stuff later.
That's like the...
We might argue.
We might argue.
Oh, wouldn't that be fun?
Yeah. Scott Nicholson, in his paper, splits up, and he's mentioned this before, he splits up the rooms into four types when it comes to narrative. This doesn't apply to tech-driven rooms, this doesn't apply to puzzles necessarily, but it does apply to narrative. There are puzzle rooms, in which has a series of puzzles, but no overarching genre, setting, or narrative. Player does not have a role other than the puzzle solver. There's nothing wrong with these rooms, but they have no narrative, and that's not what we're here to talk about today. Thematic rooms are set in a specific setting and genre, but role of the narrative is not a key part of the room. The players feel like they are somewhat somewhere, but roles are not defined. So this is your, for instance, like your Egypt rooms, your serial killer rooms, your basic generic prison rooms, especially prison rooms. You don't really have a role other than yourself. Whatever. There is a narrative room, which this is what we're seeing more of now. It has a specific genre and setting and also a narrative that is important to the room design. Players have designed roles and challenges tied into the narrative. So this is what I was talking about, is your police or your explorers or, you know, like any other thing, or your brother has been kidnapped and you need to rescue him, that kind of thing. And then we have what Scott calls hyper-narrative rooms. And these are the rooms where players have a choice about direction the narrative takes. This is something we don't see a whole lot of right now.
Have we played any that you can remember?
Nope.
Womp, womp.
It's more content design than will be seen in one playthrough. These games may change through interaction with live actors or with technology and may be designed as a replayable experience. The closest... I don't know.
Are we going to reference our rooms again?
Well, you referenced it the first time, incorrectly. I will say that our rooms probably come slightly close in that it's still a very linear story and it's still a singular outcome. However, your experience can change depending on how you interact with the actors, right? You can still have a different experience, depending on what level of interaction you want to have. So somebody, you see this more in immersive theater, I think, in that you don't change the narrative, but you do see your experiences change depending on which characters you follow around. So Sleep No More is an example. Hogtown is an example. other immersive theater things like that. Hogtown's here in Toronto, but I haven't seen much integrating of it yet. I think it would be really tough. And the other problem with story, and I didn't mention this before, is, of course, budget, right? The problem with story is that it's in order to progress and evolve as a medium, escape rooms have to experiment. The only problem with experimentation is that escape rooms cost money to run. And it's not some guy... alone designing his own video game over a period of time and just playing around with it. It's like, no, these guys have to pay rent. They have to, get customers through the door. And, we don't have time to experiment when we need to keep the business going. So, of course, it's kind of stymied by that. So I do understand that. Businesses are, the fact that you have to run a business makes it difficult to try new things all the time that you don't know is going to be a success or not.
Risky.
Risky. It's a risk. I kind of want to do a bit more, just to kind of finish it off, I want to do a bit more of a practical look at how these are applied in escape rooms. So how different story methods are applied, or how you can tell a story in escape rooms. So what devices do we have right at this moment that we use? What are the pros? What are the cons? So I'm going to start with what I think. I'm going to start from what I think is the weakest to what I think is the strongest. You may disagree with me. The weakest one, I think, is the... it's not necessarily weakest. Anyway, the pre-room talk. So this is when you go in and you pay your fee and you get a game master who... comes up, holds up a sheet of paper, maybe they hold up a sheet of paper, and they're like, you have been trapped in a tomb, and the mummy's curse is going to get you. And, right, that's a worst-case scenario of one. The pros of this, I think, are that it's the least effort required, it's the cheapest. The cons are obviously you run the risk of getting an unenthusiastic GM. You've hired a teenager who doesn't want to be there.
Hey, don't pick on the teens.
You pick on teens all the time.
Those are my teens.
Okay, all right, whatever. Many players, Errol, will phase out during this time. And that's especially bad if you have things in that pre-room talk that are required for you to finish the game later.
Although, I don't know, not too many rooms do that.
Scrap does it, a little bit.
Yeah, well, that's Scrap. I think they're the only room that does that.
The other thing is that it's a clunky information dump. The reason people check out is because you're throwing all of this information at them that isn't necessarily important, maybe in a monotone voice, and it's just... a bit of an overload. They just want to get to playing. Who cares? I want to go home now. So it doesn't really set up the player for, a fun time. Or it doesn't really set them up with the world either. However, if you're going to use it, because let's face it, not everybody can afford to have elaborate pre-room things, Try having the GM treat your players as characters. Try having the GM play a role a little bit. One of the better examples that I experienced at the Crux was when I went into an alien-themed room, and suddenly the GM turned around as he was leading us down the hallway, and we'd been talking with him before, and suddenly he went, "Okay, look, guys, the scientists are out to lunch. I don't have much time, but look, if you can just get in there and get the proof of the alien, I could really, you know, get a lot of money for it, blah, 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 blah." And he was speaking with urgency, and he was speaking like, you know, he was speaking to us like characters, and that immediately got us more in the mood to play, and it got us feeling the right, it got us in the right mood as well, right? For that's another thing you should ask your player, or you should ask of yourselves. What do you want your players to feel? Because it is about the experience. If you want them to feel tension, then yes, make a tense room. If you want them to feel happy, then maybe don't make a tense room. But at any rate, also don't overload them with too much information. It's like I was saying before. Think about what they need to know. What do they absolutely need to know to finish the room? That's probably all that should be in your pre-room talk. Leave the rest of it to the environmental storytelling to get across anything. The next one I have, and we've seen tons of these, is the pre-room video. So it's sort of like the pre-room talk in that it's an info dump. However, it can be probably a bit more consistent than a pre-room talk. You don't run the, you make one video, it's going to be the same for every player. They're going to get the same experience. You're not necessarily going to get that with like a GM. You know, some GM might, the awesome GM might go off shift, and then the crappy, tired GM will come on and, you know, give the players a terrible experience. And again, once again, it gets the players in the right mood. Cons, again, risk of information dump, and the acting might not be great. If you're going to make a video, if you're going to do a video, and a lot of people do it, make sure it's good. Make sure it's high quality. Make sure you can afford it. Yeah, people notice bad things before they notice good things, so make sure it's a good quality and keep it short, 2 to 3 minutes at most. When some videos go on 5, 6 minutes, 7 minutes, it really gets tedious, and then of course your players start to check out again, or Errol starts to check out, Mike.
Or people look for popcorn.
The other thing that I didn't put in here, but I just thought of a few minutes ago, was if you're going to do a video, do it outside of the room. When you start a video in the room, or that's when Mike goes and starts the room anyway.
Not me.
And doesn't pay attention. No, you go, Mike. And look. You go and look for the camera.
I do other things, but I don't start the room.
Takes off his shoes and sits down.
Yeah, unless the video is integral to the story, unless there's a character who's speaking to you through a video feed throughout the room, there's not much point in it. Next one, diaries. We all know diaries. Diaries are in almost every escape room in some form. There are pros to diaries. They're easy to create. They're a quick way to get character development across. No better way to see what a character is thinking than by reading it in their personal journal. They're a good spot for clues.
Although I would say that most diaries are just the ramblings of a mad person that we've read. And so all you get from it is they're mad.
Yeah, sometimes. So the cons, it takes too long to read sometimes. Most players will skim it. Even I will skim diaries because I have people being like, "What clues are in it? What clues are in it?" So I'm just skimming for numbers or things that stand out, and I don't actually read the story until after people go and try and solve the puzzles. And that leads me to the final con, which is only one player really benefits from it. Usually there's a journal reader in the group. They read the journal, they get the story, and nobody else does. And there has been a couple of moments when people were like, "I don't get why that happened that way." And then I would say, like, "Oh, it's because he thought that there were aliens taking over his brain." They'd be like, "Oh," but they wouldn't get that in the room because I was the one reading the journal. If you have to use a diary, keep it short. Remember, this is a timed room, and players' priorities are going to shift to solving puzzles or getting through the obstacles, not sitting down and having a good old read. Oh, gosh, yes, make it legible. If you can't write well, get a friend who can. There's plenty of fonts that you can use. Plenty of fonts. You know. The next one is live actors. We all have experience with this because we all use them in our games. There's a lot of pros to having live actors in your escape room, whether it's a large scale or a small scale. One is that it creates a physical connection to a character. It's a lot easier to attach yourself to a character when you can see them and talk to them. So, very easy. It deepens the immersion as well. If you have somebody who's speaking and to you as if they, like, you know, as someone would in that world, it lets you get into that world more. They're useful for hints. They're right there in the room. The downside of the hint giving is that, you know, sometimes they have to play dumb and pretend that they don't know something integral to the room. So you have to make sure if you're creating a character that it's not somebody who would know everything. And actors can help in the world creation process. Listen to your actors. And when I mean that, I mean that they can help you design your room. One of the best experiences I have with my actors is that, especially with my friend Steph, whenever she was in one of our shows, she calls me up. I give her her character. I give her her background information. And she'll call me up and ask me a million questions. And if I can't answer the questions, I know it's something I have to revisit. And usually I'm on the phone with her for an hour, and she'll make suggestions to me. And they're often very useful suggestions, because she has sat there and studied this character and thought about this character forever, because she's a good actor who does her homework. And so she'll have thoughts about it as well. So do.
Meanwhile, I haven't even read the plot.
Meanwhile, Carol's like, oh, that sounds fun. The cons is that they can be expensive. Actors are an extra cost, and, you know, not everybody can afford that.
And in rooms, you would have to pay them probably more than one, because
they longer hours. Right? Exactly. And then, not only that, but everything, and we know this from our events, everything can be interpreted as a clue. Your actors have to be very careful about what they say and what can be interpreted, and they have to be prepared to deter players from rabbit trails. We know this very well, especially when we're like, oh, yeah, I love the design of this napkin. Do you now? No, I just do. That's all. It's, I'm sure it's nothing. It's just, oh, I'm going to hope there's a napkin design that we have to get. And it's, you know, it's a very slippery slope. And the other thing is that shy players are not always fans of actors. They don't want to interact. They want to play the game. They want to get over the game, that sort of thing. And you're just going to have to accept that fact. If you do use them, make sure they have improv skills. Everything is going to be thrown at them at some point. Teach them as much about the world as possible. Again, your actors are a valuable resource. The more they know about the world, the more that they can improv it, the more that the players will believe them, that they are a part of that world. So you don't want actors making up things about your world because you forgot to tell them a detail. Errol. I forgot to tell Errol a detail, and he made up one.
Oh, yeah, I was making up all sorts of things.
Yeah.
It's glorious.
And finally, like I said, just listen to their feedback. They're in the room with the players. They will see when players are struggling. They will see when players don't get something. And they're really useful for that. So do listen to their feedback from their playthroughs. If you can't afford live actors... There is the option for pre-recorded actors or a narrator. This is either in video or audio format. Again, it's cheaper, and it's but it's still immersive. So if you find tape recorders, for instance, and videotapes and that sort of thing, it's a way to get people to know your world and characters more.
Make sure your actors are actually good.
That's one of my cons. Not that we're speaking from a specific experience or anything. The cons are that players will not always listen, and I've mentioned that before. If a narration comes on, people don't always hear it. Clues might be missed, and especially... So if they're not listening, then clues actually might be missed, and if there's no ability to repeat them, or if players start to... get sick of replaying the same video or audio over and over again to try and hear the clue. It gets really tedious and it brings them out of the experience. So get an actor, if you're going to do it, get an actor who's at least energetic and a clear reader. Get a clear reader. Make sure your audio quality is clear, especially if like you have loud music going in the room and some narration comes over top of it. Can't hear it. Doesn't help. Now I'm going to get into the more environmental stuff. So there's the set design. When you're building a room, you want to make sure that your set makes sense to the world and everything in it. It shows players your world and story rather than tells it. The set is very useful. If you walk into a living room and it looks dingy, you could think somebody, you know, maybe it's been abandoned for a while. Or if you walk in and it's pristine, it could be some wealthy couple lives there. It builds the world as well as the narrative, like I said. It builds atmosphere. So I just mentioned the dingy living room. You walk in there, you feel kind of uncomfortable. You know, that's what you want your players to feel, so you want your set to reflect that. And it can use more than one sense. So Errol's mentioned this before, but you don't have to just use sight. You can use, I'll get to audio, you can use smell as well. Errol mentioned a room where smell-o-vision.
Maybe not as a puzzle, but, you know, at least have that scent. The only problem with smell is that some people will be allergic to it.
Some people will be allergic, and when I did the UN conference in February, there was a great debate that emerged about using scent in a room. Do use scent if you want to, but keep in mind the power of your scent, the type of scent. If it's something like incense, that might turn people off and think, is there another way to get across what type of world this is without using such a strong smell like that, because you will get people who are sensitive to it. The cons are it can be expensive depending on the theme that you choose, the set that you build. So when you're building your set, when you're choosing your themes, just choose a setting. I have this very specifically written. Choose a setting that is within your abilities and resources. If you're the only escape room in town, then you might be able to build an Egypt set that, you know, out of cardboard, and people will be fine with it. But especially when you're in an escape-heavy town, people will notice a poor set before they will notice a good set. Or a decent one. It may not be amazing, but it'll be decent. So, yeah, choose a set that you can actually build. Oh, yeah, and also make sure that there are no extraneous props. So as important as environmental storytelling is, the more props you have in a room, the more possibilities your players will construe it as a clue or a puzzle, and they will try and solve something that doesn't actually exist. So be very selective. Make sure that every prop you have in there has a purpose. It's like Chekhov's gun. That's what the term is.
Although I would say for an escape room, that just means you have to have a stronger puzzle design.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, I don't mind if you're going to put, for example, if you're in an office and you have a telephone and you actually never use, well, you might use a telephone. I don't know. Maybe a painting. You know, not everything has to be used. You still want it to look like the real world.
Yep.
But
you
it
do.
Has to be, I think the puzzle design has to be strong so that nobody would be completely confused. Like, for example.
Okay, so if you're thinking like, are you thinking like when people get frustrated and then they start looking to other things?
Yes.
Okay.
Right? I mean, think about video games. I mean, video games are really handy because if it doesn't fit if you don't need to interact with it, you can't. But in escape rooms, they can touch everything.
Yeah.
And they will probably assume everything is a clue. Remember, when we do our events, we are doing it in existing buildings. And so there, if you think about it, there's everything there is
that
not
is true.
Part of the puzzle.
That's
right?
Very
All
true.
All of our events, tons of stuff is not part.
I was super scared about the Arts and Letters Club because there was all this artwork on the walls.
Yeah, and so I had to make sure that it's very clear without pointing it out what they can and can't do and through the puzzle design.
Good points. The other thing is you can use sound as well. Not just narration, not just music even, but think about what kind of sounds your world would make. You know, if you're in a bunker, like there might not be anything. Or if you're in a cave, it might drip. If you're in a forest, you might hear birds. If you're in on a spaceship, you might hear aliens. Okay, that's it. Ruby. I wanted to hear what Ruby's alien sound was. That's why I said that.
That's a pigeon.
That's a pigeon.
What aliens are that's your you cat.
No, my cat's.
No, your cat goes.
That's because she's sick.
But it does a lot more to build atmosphere and narrative. And players will get just as much narrative out of walking into a room that looks abandoned and decrepit than if they walked into a room and somebody was there saying, "This is abandoned for 20 years," right? Like, you just have to give the sense of it. One of the last ones I'm going to mention, I haven't seen this a lot, but it's people are experimenting with it more, is the hint system. A hint system can be a very useful narrative tool. The one thing I haven't seen yet that I would love to see is a character talking to you over that walkie-talkie rather than just a GM. Yes, Mike?
I've seen it.
Where? Yeah.
I don't think you've done this room, but have you done Perplexity's elevator room?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we have. So.
Oh, okay. Maybe not in your game then.
No, we didn't have that. However, it was... In book club killer. Oh yeah, there was that, but that was over the phone.
Yeah,
I haven't seen much of it. That's the thing. Adventure.
Oh yeah, right.
That was a good one.
To a character.
That was a good one.
So,
which is now the crux.
If players are talking to a character rather than just a GM, because the hint systems are often the things that suddenly stop the game and drag people out of it, and it interrupts the experience, and there's no good way to do it. So, you know, if you use that hint system to your advantage, if you make it more about character development, then, or if you make it a way to enhance the narrative, then that can greatly increase a player experience without you having to break the bank for it. It's a very simple tool, and I don't see it used all that often yet. So... But where I have seen it, it's been great. We've seen, again, we don't want to spoil it, though, but there's a great hint system at Escape Maze that we enjoy that works with the theme of the room. And when you're doing your hint systems, think about the theme of your room, think about the story, and think about how people might receive information in that room. It's closed now, but like you said, LogQuest, you're in a house, and the telephone rings, and it's a character on the other end, and you talk to them, and they will give you a hint. And it's a much better way of staying in the experience than if the GM were just to call you and be like, "Are you stuck?"
Or just walk in the room and be like, "Okay, what are you working on?
Right? And you want to make that experience.
Oh, you weren't supposed to move that. I've had that happen. You weren't supposed to move that.
No.
And I will say that it can be difficult given the... depending on what theme you have and the availability of game masters. So the more complex hint system you have, the more your game masters have to be on it all the time. Finally, sorry guys, this is turning out to be long.
Getting to the end.
Finally, we have puzzles. Puzzles must adhere to the narrative, and vice versa. The narrative must adhere to the puzzles. The narrative... And the pros of this, of making sure that your puzzles fit your narrative and fit your theme, is that it ensures players will pay attention. If you embed if you embed your narrative into the puzzles itself, if you learn something about the narrative through doing the puzzles, that's the golden moment that you like. That's like the nirvana that you want to reach in an escape room. It increases immersion. The only con I can think of is that it's difficult to pull off. It is difficult to make a puzzle seem completely natural to a room. And, but if you do it, the thing that we see very often when somebody solves a puzzle, the story is often the reward for it. And that actually shouldn't be the way it is. Oh. Should actually be more of a part of the process itself. It shouldn't be like just this afterthought, like, "Oh, you open the box. Here's a diary page. Read it," and then somebody throws it away and, you know, doesn't pay attention.
We give it to you.
You give it to me, and then I'm like, oh, that's fun. And I'm like, hey, guys, you want to hear about? No. Okay. And then we move on, because we have to solve puzzles. When you're... So, that's pretty much what I have. I have some couple of final thoughts before, you know, we wrap it up. The thing to remember always is that players are there for an experience. And yes, it is about puzzles. Puzzles are very important to escape rooms. But the average person walking in off the street wants an adventure as much as they do a challenge. And I think I mentioned that earlier too, but it bears repeating. Yes, Errol.
I think the hard thing about story is that for the most part, it's hard to make a good story.
Yes.
And even if you try really hard to make a story fit in your game, it's probably not going to be an interesting one. I mean, that sounds really harsh, but are thousands and millions, of stories, sketches, TV. The medium is huge, and a lot of those can't seem to tell us stories. Well,
no, of course, and you shouldn't be afraid to make a non-interesting story, but you should make a solid story.
Yes.
That's what I'm saying.
It should be a solid story, but then that's why it's hard to engage us. Because A, sometimes the story isn't interesting. And then B, the main characters are us.
Yes.
And that is hard, because what if we don't really want to get involved in the story? It's like when you see characters that just decide, I know I'm the main character, but I'm not really going to play the part. I'm just going to get through it. So and that's certainly a fine way to play it.
I think you have to be accommodating to your players and to understand that some of them are going to do it that way. That doesn't mean that you shouldn't put effort into it. Because here's the thing about, if you make a consistent story, if you make a consistent world, if you make a consistent characters, most players probably will not notice it. But they will definitely notice inconsistencies. And that's something you want to avoid. And that is why you put the effort that you do. Trust me when I say I put a lot of thought into the plots that we do for our shows, but most players don't even get an inkling of it because they're there just to play. But it does mean that they get an experience that is consistent, and they won't complain about it afterwards. They won't see any... If they see something that's out of place, then we haven't done our job. If they see something and they're brought out of the experience, Errol looks like he's going to say something again.
Nope. No,
okay.
Go ahead.
Okay. So as frustrating as it is, you know, because we're not there with escape room storytelling yet. We're not. We're still experimenting. We're still kind of feeling it out. We don't even know We don't even know if escape rooms are going to be an art form of any sort in the future. But if we want them to be, then we have to be willing to evolve and to experiment at some point. There are, like Errol said, it's hard to make an interesting story. One way of doing it is to, as Scott said in the last podcast, take advantage of your local history. Especially if you're in like a smaller town escape room and you're trying to figure out how to get people to come or to get tourists to come as well. Find out what your history is. Capitalize on that, because it really makes your escape room stand out. It makes it a little more unique than the other escape rooms that might be around if you use an actual historical event. Now, if you're going to do that, research the crap out of it. One, you'll get the nerds that will come and will say, like, you got this detail wrong. Two, if you really get it wrong... and I'm thinking of one room in particular, then it really messes up the experience and it does a disservice to the historical event itself.
I think Weiwa talked about that in regards to puzzles. There's a rule out there for puzzles that when you design one, don't make a puzzle that is beyond your own knowledge level.
Mm.
Because if you decide that you're going to make a puzzle that's dependent on basic chemistry, and you create it, for example, but you don't know anything about chemistry, and then a chemist comes along and says, all of this is wrong, although you're still trying, so good job, but it doesn't make sense whatsoever. Do you know what I mean? I mean, yeah. there is some leeway there, but it's, or if somebody made a music puzzle for me, mm-hmm. and then all of a sudden they just had the notes wrong for some strange reason, I would go, why are you making a music puzzle that's dependent on music knowledge, but these are all wrong? That doesn't make any sense. So,
right.
I would say the same thing for what you said about nerds.
Absolutely.
Nerds.
So Jet Lake, so if you're looking to expand your story experience, if you are looking to try things out, play as many games as you can. This is both escape rooms, this is video games. See what other mediums are doing with the stories and see how you might be able to do it. The more that you do, the more information you will actually subconsciously get about how a story is structured and what makes it good. Really think about why you feel the way you feel. Why are you attracted to this one story but not another in a game?
I steal all my experiences that I make my players do from video games.
There you go. So, right?
So I'm not even talking about stories. I think, what kind of cool experiences can these people do? And I've said this many times. Mm-hmm. But since they're the main characters, they should have really cool experiences for them to act out, I guess you could say.
Exactly.
Like stealing. How are you doing over there, Mike?
We're almost done.
Mike is falling asleep.
Sorry, Mike.
Oh, I think he has allergies to the bunny.
Yeah.
Oh, are you allergic to the bunny? Which bunny? We have two now.
The one that Ruby was rubbing and put on me and rubbed the fur on me.
Oh. I didn't do any of that. The bunny walked over, she was
alone. With you lifting it towards me.
Okay, two more points and then I'm done. And they're really quick points too. The second last suggestion I have is, when you're workshopping, make it part of your beta test. If you're concentrating more on story and you're curious to see what your players got out of it, make it part of your questioning process afterwards. Sure, ask them what they found most difficult and whatnot, but also ask them, so what happened in the game and how did you feel? And like, what happened in the story? What can you remember? And that will really give you an indication as to how much impact it's having. If they're not getting anything out of it, you know, that might just be like par for the course, or you might want to rethink about how you present it. And then finally, and I've said this many times, actually, you will always put way more work into your design than players will notice. And yes, that's frustrating. So it sucks, but believe me, it's way worth the effort. It may not seem like it. People will rarely tell you when you're doing things right. Because unless you have an amazing, amazing escape room, because they'll tell you about that. They'll tell you about the amazing stuff. They won't tell you when your escape room is decent. They will tell you when anything that goes wrong. They might not, but you can tell. They'll always be like, thanks, we gotta go now. No, that's okay. We don't need to play another one. Yeah, I know we booked it, but we gotta go. People are way less subtle, so it's definitely worth it. And if we want to see the medium evolve, I think this is the thing we need to concentrate on. Whew, gosh, darn it. How long was that? An hour and a half?
An hour and a half. You go, man pans.
I could talk many times about it. I might go more into depth if I write something else about it. If you're curious, if you want to talk further about it, by all means, email us.
Email her.
Email us. roomescapedivas@gmail.com. And
oh, is this the outro?
No, this isn't the outro. Do you have any final thoughts, Errol?
Oh, no. It's an hour and a half in.
Okay, sorry.
No.
Mike and Ruby, how are you?
Mike's having problems because of bunny allergies.
My eyes itchy.
Oh, no.
Were you like putting the bunny in your face?
No.
That's what my daughter does. She uses the face cloth running. Kids.
So I pretty much said my unconference presentation, but we do have the slides available if you want to see.
Codex.ca.
On the codex.ca, not codex.ca. And in that, at the end, I have like recommendations for reading, games you might want to play, that kind of thing. So.
And we have some exciting new episodes coming up soon, too. But
yeah,
we won't talk about it yet.
Anyway, thanks for sticking around, guys. I hope it wasn't too boring.
More disclaimers from Man Pants.
Yeah. I mean, it was awesome. I love story. I really do. I had a different way of presenting this at the Young Conference. I started it with a story about Myst, but I decided not to do it this time. Anyway.
Take us out, Man Pants.
I'm taking me out. All right. Room Escape Divas is brought to you by Inverse Genius. You can go to InverseGenius.com. I will smash that Totoro.
What? I didn't do anything!
I will smash...
I haven't done a thing!
I will smash that Totoro. Go to InverseGenius.com to find other fun podcasts just like this one. You can also go to Facebook. Double, just click double, the like button on the Room Escape Divas Facebook page. You're doing an inside joke on stupid outro. You can also email us at roomescapedivas@gmail.com. And you can go to Twitter and use the hashtag RedDivas.
Almost.
Almost. Thanks, guys.
Bye-bye.